Shifting to a high social status. Many people think that in order to effectively project a high social status, one had to be extremely wealthy or extremely influential in business. As I have already mentioned, these factors are really not necessary to increase a person's social status or personal power for that matter. Having a high social status really revolves around specific personal qualities that are separate from how a person dresses or jet sets around town. To illustrate this, let me bring you back to a time when you were a child at school. Try to think of the different teachers that you've encountered when you were young. There are generally three kinds of mentors that children meet as they pass through primary schooling. The first kind of mentor was too nice and too kind to children. Niceness begets niceness, right? Not in primary school. These mentors are the ones who usually have to deal with extremely rowdy kids. Kids feel that these teachers have no ability to become authorities or leaders in class, and so the students behave in accordance to the status that the teachers project. As a result, these teachers have little or no control over what happens in the classroom, and more than a handful have left their classes in tears. The second kind of mentor is the exact opposite of the first type. They are aware of what their position entails, and they overuse their power. They are brutally authoritative in class. They have little or no tolerance for mistakes or errors in behavior. As a result, children quake at their presence. They are universally disliked or even hated because of how they relate to their students. These mentors might be hardworking mothers or fathers, but in the classroom, they are representatives of the underworld. Their names bring tremors of terror in the hearts of old and new students alike. The third type of mentor is the most balanced among the three archetypes. He is the perfect mix of niceness and authority in the classroom. He exudes confidence, and he doesn't have to resort to grand gestures, such as shouting harshly to get a point across, just to get the students to listen to what he has to say. He is known to be kind, but also a powerful authority figure in times of trouble. The third archetypal teacher is the model of high status that we are looking for. Teachers who fall into this category may not be aware that they are projecting a high social status, but they are. And whether they like it or not, people around them are keen to treat them as persons with such a social status because they project it so naturally in the way they behave and communicate with other people. Why are these people so different from people who fall into the first two categories? Here are the most essential differences. They are kind without being too kind to the point that they are abused by others. They are able to discipline effectively. Students willingly submit themselves to the disciplining because they respect these mentors. They are comfortable with who they are and what they do, and finally, they know how to put other people at ease. I know that this seems like a tall order for folks who have never really thought of these traits as signs of a high social status, but trust me, once you start making traits such as these an integral part of who you are, the shift in your projected social status will transpire more easily. Can this pivotal change in your social status and personal identity happen overnight? Probably not. Can it happen within a week or perhaps a month? Yes, but like everything else in this world, you have to work hard for the change to truly take place. If you are ready to make the shift, here are the four most important signals that you will need to project a high social status. Signal number one. The first signal of high social status is being calm and behaving purposefully. People with high social status rarely act like their heads are on fire. If you've ever seen or talked to a person like that, you probably thought that the other person was a little bit off his rocker because of his behavior. So if you want to raise your social status, you need to start being more calm around people. Calmness begets calmness in most cases. So whether you are at home or at work with colleagues that you don't get along with, your newfound calmness will create tides of change. If you are not used to being calm and you prefer being all over the place because that's how you've behaved for years, then I suggest that you take the baby steps towards change. You do not have to change this particular facet of your personality overnight, but believe me, baby steps will get you there. Start by just being more patient with people. Also, learn to listen more than talk. When you learn how to truly listen to people, you will be amazed at how much more you can accomplish by getting more feedback from people compared to just barking orders across the room. In addition to being calmer around others, you also need to modify your speech a little bit so that you will begin to exude a sense of purposefulness. How is this done? Well, a purposeful person has no real reason to act hurried, anxious, or harassed. He has his mind set at specific goals, and because he is set on accomplishing things, he feels comfortable and relaxed all the time. You can project this mindset by slowing down your speech rate and really focusing on expressing the meaning of words as you speak them. Also, don't speak as if a train is after you. Do not forget to add pauses so you can rest a little in preparation for the next set of statements that you would like to share with your subject. When you pause regularly during your conversations, both the speaker and subject are able to rest their minds momentarily. This gives both parties a chance to process the information more efficiently and also allows the subject to breathe, which is awesome because this is one of the core principles of fractionated rapport. Remember? There are also some things that you might want to avoid if you don't want to project anxiety or nervousness. Jerky and unpredictable movements while talking. Attention wavers and changes from time to time. For example, one moment you're talking about one idea and then you suddenly jump to another one just because you thought about it. Repeating random movements, such as touching your ears or face, drumming on the table, etc. Using expressions like and okay to punctuate your speech. These expressions are distracting, and they destroy the flow of your speech. If you need to remember something, don't say while you're trying to recall it. Make a full stop and then start again. Also, when people hear a lot of and they begin to think that the other person does not really know what he is saying in the first place. If you want to gain compliance from someone, it would be difficult to convince that person that you are an authority if you don't exude the correct signals. Signal number 2. The second sign of high status is the comfortable and strategic use of space. Your personal space is not limited to the immediate space that surrounds you. You can actually expand and reduce the usable space that you have when talking to people. People with low status will try to utilize as little space as possible when interacting with others. A person with such a status will find a spot or a chair to sit on and will try to be as unobtrusive as possible. In order to project a high status, you need to expand your immediate space a little bit. When you sit down, you have to exude that you are comfortable in your own skin and you are definitely happy with what you are doing. When you start talking to others, you must not be afraid to invade their own personal space if you have to. For example, if you are talking to a group of potential customers, you may have to come close to one of them to emphasize a point or to show the customer that you are in charge of the situation. You must also use the right gestures and movements in the right degrees. Do not try to overcompensate with your body language, as this can backfire. What does overcompensation look like in the context of space usage and body language? Well, our best models for overcompensation would be insecure teenagers. Insecure teenagers tend to have a lot of angst and are generally sullen. They feel antisocial, but deep down they are not very sure of themselves, and so they overcompensate. Most teenagers occupy more than a seat's worth of space when they sit down in public trains or in the park. When they are with their friends, they use grand gestures and are very loud and obnoxious. To cover up their insecurities, many teenagers overcompensate to project a high status. Does it work? Sometimes it does work with their fellow teenagers, but oftentimes it doesn't work with the people that they intend to please or impress, the adults. Projecting a high status takes time, and again, it is not going to take place overnight. But all the same, you should start working on it now, because the ultimate goal is to exude the social status as naturally as possible. Because we don't want people to think that you are just pretending to have a high social status. We want them to think that a high social status is your regular status in life. Remember, a high social status doesn't mean that you are out to boss around people and act all great and lofty. A high social status means you have a high degree of control over what is happening in your surroundings, that is, over people and events. Signal number 3. The third sign of high status is exposing your vulnerable regions while interacting with people. The human body has 3 vulnerable regions, the abdominal cavity, the throat, and the groin area. The abdominal cavity is vulnerable because you have a lot of important organs there, but no bones to cover them. The throat has a lot of important arteries and veins that need to be protected. The groin region houses the reproductive organs in both males and females. So humans have a natural tendency to protect these three regions because that is part of our survival instincts. Now, our ancestors probably had to really protect these areas because they needed to survive in hostile environments. Most of us no longer live in hostile environments, but that does not mean that we have lost the instinct to protect these regions. We protect them through our body language. For example, a nervous person might fiddle with his tie or the topmost button of his suit so he can touch and shield his throat while talking. Unless there is a real physical danger, people no longer shield the three vulnerable regions. Well, at least not fully. Through a person's body language, you can still see if he feels that he is threatened and he's about to be attacked. There are certain gestures that subtly protect the three vulnerable regions from harm. Here are the gestures. 1. Touching the neck. 2. Touching the fabric covering the neck. 3. Linking the hands in front of the groin. 4. Placing one arm across the abdomen. 5. Linking the hands and resting them on top of the abdomen. 6. Resting one arm across the abdomen while holding a drink. 7. Fixing a button near the center of a suit, near the abdomen. 8. Placing the hands in both coat pockets and positioning the arms in such a way that you are giving yourself a semi-hug. Always keep in mind that people with high social status have a natural courage and confidence that removes the need to protect the three vulnerable regions. Keep your arms and hands away from these areas. Gesture to your audience so that you can express your ideas more effectively. Avoid any gesture that shields or bars any of your vulnerable regions, because whether you like it or not, your audience will take those gestures as signs of weakness and low social status. Signal number 4. The fourth sign of high social status is eye contact. Remember those old movies where the ruggedly handsome lead man almost always gets the pretty ladies? All these lead characters have one thing in common. They really knew how to create and maintain intense eye contact. Of course, in real life, the impact of eye contact in semi-romantic settings will vary, but my point is you need to have confidence to make eye contact with your audience. The human eyes are very expressive, and there are a lot of things that you can express through your eyes. You can get favorable, passive feedback from your audience through eye contact. You can express emotions and intensity through eye contact, too. And finally, the eyes are a window to one's mental state. A confident person will be able to maintain eye contact because he is set to do something at that moment. A nervous person with little or no self-confidence will look at different spots throughout the room because he is not comfortable with what he is doing in the first place. Darting eyes never exude confidence. When a person's eyes begin to dart around the room, he's really saying, "I would rather be anywhere else in this room but where I am right now." In short, when you allow your eyes to dart around, you are really saying that you don't want to talk to your audience. Your audience will probably not mind the random eye movements, but deep down they're thinking, "What's up with his eyes? Why can't he look at us?" Microsignals are so important that they can eventually affect the final action of the subject. Because after rapport and mental compliance, there is still the final step, action. If you cannot convince them to take action, then the mental compliance becomes meaningless. And in cases where you have to show that you have a high social status, you won't be able to impress anyone if your outward projection is dissonant with what you think you are projecting to your audience. Tactic number 2. After shifting your social status so that you will be able to project an air of confidence and personal power when talking to your subject, it's time to move on to the second principle, consistency. We have briefly touched upon the consistency principle in an earlier part of the book, but I'm going to repeat it here just so you can review what it's all about. When someone says something, they are forced to be consistent with their own pronouncements, especially when they are in the presence of others. Now, here's the thing about people in general. Alone, they can ignore their own pronouncements. People can choose not to be accountable with their own words. This changes when a person is in the presence of another individual with a high social status. When a person is in the presence of someone with high social status, he feels obliged to be consistent with his words. Why is it so important to project a high social status when you need someone to do something for you? Well, the conversation itself should yield the desired outcome, which is action. But oftentimes, people tend to sidestep or back out just before they can say, "I will do it." We want to avoid this as much as possible. We want people to mentally comply and then follow through with real action. And you can say we are forcing people to live up to their verbal compliance through a demonstration of expanded personal power. In short, you will be making the subject feel that he is obliged to comply with you, even if you don't say it. Now remember that in any social setting, you can easily demonstrate your status by acting as the pack leader or authority. You can do this by subtly drawing attention to yourself, by demonstrating that you can communicate well, and you can communicate the best ideas. This can easily be seen in the high school or in the university. There will always be those students who seem to know how to engage everyone with their ideas, no matter how simple those ideas are. When you communicate with a purpose, with no qualms or inhibitions, you take up the role of a leader, and people around you will respond to your new role immediately, even if they do not consciously acknowledge you as a leader. The art of personality typing. What separates introverts from extroverts? How do you tell them apart? What are the signs that a person is either an introvert or an extrovert? These are the basic questions that we will attempt to answer in this section. When I talk about introverts and extroverts, or personality types in general, people usually ask me, is there a fixed code that conversational hypnotists can use to determine the exact personality type of a person? The answer is no, unfortunately. But don't let this discourage you from attempting to determine whether a person is an introvert or an extrovert. While it is true that there are no hard and fast rules that will indicate whether a person is an introvert or extrovert, there are some very reliable language-based guidelines that you can use during conversations. These language-based guidelines are easy to remember and can be applied in most situations, so you can just modify your questions to fit the situation. The best thing about personality typing is that the whole process of creating an insightful profile of your subject can be integrated naturally to your dialogue. So it doesn't matter if you're talking to a new acquaintance or an old friend. As long as you can accurately enunciate the right questions to your subject, you will get the feedbacks necessary to determine whether your subject is introverted or extroverted. Why is it important to determine a hypnotic subject's personality type? The main reason is that people have very specific tendencies and needs, and these factors greatly influence how a person would respond in certain situations. So if you talk to someone with the intent of getting something out of the interaction, you have to know first what type of personality he has so you can structure your dialogue in such a way that it will be received well by your subject. After our discussion of introverts and extroverts, we will be talking about other high-level personality types, so you would have an even broader knowledge of how people think and perceive the world around them based on their high-level personality categories. The first thing you have to remember about introverts and extroverts is that people from both groups can have the exact same opinion about issues, but they would have a different way of enunciating their beliefs and opinions. Introverted individuals, for example, are more likely to refer to the self when speaking to others. Here are some sample statements that are associated with introverted individuals. Notice how the I, or the self, is used frequently in the statements in its various forms. Take notice of the emphasized words as well. These words are also associated with introverted thinkers. I feel that the world would be a better place if there was no war, only peace in every country. I like the taste of chocolate shakes. I want that new handbag myself. I personally believe that the guy was guilty. They let him off too easily. I firmly believe that what I did was the right thing. I won't let them stop me from fulfilling my dreams. Something feels wrong, but I can't quite put a finger on it. When I try to picture the whole scene. I get confused quite a lot. Think about it. Imagine all the pain he's going through right now. It really breaks my heart to see him in such a state. As you may have already noticed, introverted statements often refer to the speaker himself and to the concept of the I. An introverted individual will always make it clear that what he is saying is his personal belief, and it also logically follows that these beliefs are extremely important to the subject. Introverted individuals are known for being very protective about their beliefs, so be careful about directly challenging inferences and assumptions from introverts. Introverts are willing to duke it out to defend their personal beliefs. What about extroverts? How do extroverted individuals express themselves? In the next paragraph, I will be sharing with you some statements associated with extroverted thinking. Pay attention to the emphasized words and how the statements sound when you hear them. Extroverts are more likely to talk about other people, and they are generally less defensive about their beliefs than introverts. If an introverted individual is more likely to talk about himself, extroverts are more interested in referring to other people during conversations, even if they are sharing their personal beliefs and opinions. Here are the statements. You know for a fact that the world will not end on December 21st, 2012. You can't be sure that the ginger goes with the soy sauce in this stir-fry recipe. We always make it a point to go out at least once a week to unwind, kick back, and just enjoy life. Do you enjoy going to the movies? I like this dog. It's sociable. Notice how an extrovert can use the I but still express extroverted thinking by using the term sociable to describe an animal. Bungee jumping is exhilarating. It is the best experience in the world. By simply studying a person's choice of linguistic expressions, a hypnotist would be able to determine if a person was leaning towards extroversion or introversion. Here are some additional guidelines to help you determine if your subject is an introvert or extrovert. First, as with any other interaction, do not forget to establish rapport with your subject first before employing any hypnotic or linguistic technique. Trust is extremely important during personality typing, because you need to get genuine feedback from your subjects. If your subject does not trust you at all you will get from him are very guarded answers. We don't want that. We want your subject to just open the floodgates so his personality will shine through when he expresses himself. If you need an example as to how to make someone comfortable during an interaction, watch known personalities like Jay Leno or Conan O'Brien. They have the innate ability to make people comfortable and happy on set. Emulate how they express themselves, and you will see masters of rapport at work. Next, an introverted individual might be very knowledgeable about something, but he can't help but put himself at the very center when he is expressing himself. He will make it clear that he is expressing his personal beliefs, and he is not espousing anyone else's take on the issue. Third, an extroverted individual might be willing to share his personal beliefs with others, but unless you are someone that he really trusts or looks up to, an extrovert would be more comfortable talking about what other people think and feel about a certain issue. Extroverts are more knowledgeable about what is happening outside of themselves. They are not very reflective generally because their interest lies in assimilating and expressing what they see and hear. Another unique tendency of extroverts is that they like creating contrast between themselves and others. There are always binaries involved. These binaries are expressed through terms like we, them, us, etc. 4. Both introverts and extroverts use a variety of words to fully express their thoughts and beliefs. An introvert might refer to other people if he needs to. An extrovert might sound reflective because he can also use I more than we or them. Don't let this confuse you. If your subject is code shifting, simply tally how many times he uses introverted terminology as opposed to extroverted terminology. If your subject is merely sprinkling I's and has a huge tendency to refer to other people when he talks, then the usage of the I has no bearing on his personality type. He is still an extrovert based on how he creates contrast between himself and others. Now that you have a good idea as to how you can identify introverts and extroverts, let's make the discussion even more interesting by exploring some high-level personality types. These personality types are used extensively in psychology, and as a conversational hypnotist, you will definitely benefit from knowing these personality types as well. First is the duty-bound individual. The duty-bound individual is concerned with his obligations and responsibilities. He is also preoccupied with making sure that all of his current tasks are accomplished with precision. This person loves stability over all else. Next, the adventurer. A natural risk-taker, the adventurer is interested in living life to the fullest. He is also attached to the idea of making things work and taking apart things to see how they operate. Third is the artist. Has high appreciation for beauty and aesthetics. The artist tries to avoid any kind of conflict and prefers the peaceful life over adventure and any potential source of instability and risk. Fourth is the doer. The doer does not stay put for long. He is preoccupied with finding solutions to problems and acting upon his meditations to see if something would become better when he acts upon his decisions. Fifth, the performer. Similar to the adventurer, the performer is concerned with making life vibrant and happy for everyone, has some appreciation for adventure and risk, but is more concerned with being the life of the party. Next is the scientist, an absolute thinker and doer. The scientist is interested in learning the various abstractions and theories of life, but is not satisfied in just learning these things. Once he masters a theory, he sets out to find out if the theory is practical or not. And last, the leader. Natural pack leaders. They thrive in creating solutions for people, likes structure, and also thrives in creating systems that will serve specific purposes. Outgoing and courageous, the leader is not afraid to speak his mind, even if it means he has to challenge existing beliefs and conventions. People look up to him for wisdom and guidance. The leader, because of his tendency to be first in line to solve a problem, is also characterized as having very little patience with individuals who are inefficient or clumsy in solving problems.